Okay. I'd like to continue a bit on what we mentioned last week, and that is the spilling of the seed, the practice of masturbation, which the Tosafists explain that if one is not commanded in the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiplying, that is, having an offspring, procreation, so then this prohibition does not exist as well. And I would just like to, I think there's something that we should explain about this, and that is that in the pagan religions, there is a taboo system about certain things. And in a certain instance, masturbation is one of them. And in halacha, however, we must remember that the halacha does not work with any kind of a taboo system. And everything is based upon the rational commandments of Torah, and we analyze every area, sexual or otherwise, and everything comes under the scrutiny of the mind and the halacha. The halacha is a unique system, not to be found in any other religion, as you're familiar. Over here again, the prohibition against masturbation is based upon the command of procreation. So if there is no command of procreation, then there's no prohibition against masturbation. But there is one thing that I would like to mention in that regard, that in the halacha, we mentioned last week that for the Ben Noach, the command of procreation was removed, and that only existed until the giving of the Torah at Sinai. However, for the Ben Israel, once the institution of Torah came into existence, so then the Ben Israel took the command, and it became voluntary for the rest of the world. What I would like to mention is also, I think, you know, there are two things. There is, in halacha, there is the rigid structure of the halacha. Then there is perfection, which goes beyond the halacha, which the halacha can point to. All halacha is perfection, but perfection goes even beyond the halachic system. Not everything that is permitted is perfection. And we've mentioned this a number of times. Now, it's interesting to take a look at the structure of the law with regard to procreation and masturbation, because the Ben Noach is, we mentioned many times, that while seven social violations, which if people do not do, they're not worthy of existence, a Ben Noach that's interested in perfection is interested in going beyond that, and that's where all the other commandments and the perfections of the Torah come in. And this is for any human being that wishes to attain perfection. So it's important to understand the structure of the law with regard to the Ben Israel many times in order to deduce the perfection that a Ben Noach can voluntarily involve himself or herself in. Okay? Now, it's interesting, in the structure of the law with regard to the command of procreation and the auxiliary or accompanying prohibition of masturbation, that once one is under that command, for instance, the Ben Israel, then masturbation becomes prohibited. It becomes prohibited in any instance, okay? Not just in an instance where it would result in a lack of procreation, like in the case of Er and Onan in the Bible, all right, where they spill their seed. That was coitus interruptus, where they spill their seed rather than consummate the sexual act. But any kind of act of masturbation, even if it didn't mean the person wasn't involved in procreation, it didn't inhibit his procreation, would still be prohibited. And the question, of course, is why? So here we see that the Torah, when it prohibited the masturbation, it prohibited the entire gamut, which means satisfaction of the sexual instinct through fantasy. So once there was a commandment to procreate, the prohibition wasn't just in terms of an individual act, but rather the whole institution of masturbation was prohibited, which means the institution of being involved in sexual gratification through fantasy and the act of masturbation became completely prohibited. Now, In my mind, that demonstrates, I believe there's something to be derived from the way the halacha was structured in that area. That it didn't just prohibit for the Ben Israel an act of masturbation which would prevent procreation, but any act at all, at any time, is prohibited. In other words, the entire involvement in that kind of activity became prohibited for the male, Ben Israel, because he is obligated in procreation. I think there's something to be derived from the way that law was structured, okay? It could have been structured two ways. It could have been structured just in the form of onanism, but it wasn't. It was structured across the board. And I believe there's a reason for that, because I believe it indicates a certain perfection in man. In other words, in general, in the eyes of the Torah, the being indulging oneself in the world of fantasy and not reality is really an imperfection. Okay? That's why God wants man to engage himself in the real world. In other words, his satisfactions should be those of the real world and not of the fantasy world. The Torah is very against a human being recoiling from reality and going into the world of fantasy. I believe for that reason, when the prohibition was formulated, it was formulated against the entire institution of masturbation, regardless of whether it it actually impedes procreation. The reason is because it is an imperfection on the part of man to engage in the world of sexual fantasy and not in the world of reality which God gave him. So, therefore, the reason why I mention this is because I believe from the formula of the prohibition, one can learn something, and that is that if a person is seeking perfection, that they would avoid the world of satisfaction via fantasy, because it is God's will that ultimately the perfected man should engage himself in the world that God created for him in reality and not in the world of fantasy. So therefore, while the prohibition there is no prohibition technically in terms of masturbation, if there is no accompanying commandment to procreate, so it is not a technical halachic violation. Nevertheless, a person that is really seeking perfection to the highest degree still wouldn't engage in that practice, because there is a general principle here which is also being shown, and that is that the ultimate human being is to avail himself of God's world, the real world God created, and to recoil into the world of fantasy is really a human defect. Although it would still not come under a prohibition unless there was a command to procreate. But when there is a command to procreate, then the prohibition is across the board, and the entire institution of fantasy sexualism is of course, proscribed, is prohibited. So therefore, what I'm saying is that there is many times when we investigate the structure of the law, from the very structure of the halacha, one can determine what perfection really is, and he who is seeking perfection will guide himself or herself in that direction. So the law serves two purposes. The law serves the purpose of telling us what is strictly considered involving oneself in something which is halachically not proper, and it also delineates and points towards what the highest level of human perfection is. And in this case, of course, it is an important concept, because I think that if a person wants to guide their lives by the ideas of Torah, it's important not just to guide oneself by the halacha alone, but rather by the perfection which the halacha always points to. And even though there is no prohibition in many cases, if a person looks carefully into the halachic system and sees that something which is permissible is still not considered the highest level of human activity, one should always try to guide themselves towards the highest level that is attainable to them. Okay? So So therefore, in studying the halacha, we accomplish two things. We find out what the halacha is, the rigid structure, which is, of course, the essence of the whole system, and then also the way to perfect ourselves and guide ourselves towards the higher level of existence, which is every human being's purpose in life. And as I've mentioned before, Ramban mentions this, and many scholars, the Talmudic scholars mention this. They say that a person should make himself sanctified with that which is permitted to him. Even things that are permitted, a person should sanctify himself by understanding that certain things that a person does, they may be permissible, but they will not raise him or her to a higher level. That's why it's important to understand the halachic structure, so we get not only what the prohibition is, but what the direction is for perfecting ourselves and living the highest kind of existence. I thought it was important to mention that point while we were on this topic. Are there any questions? Okay, if not, then we'll proceed. We'll return to where we left off a while ago in the tractate of Sanhedrin, and that is 56b. Okay? And now we're going to 56b, and we're going to study the way the rabbis, the way the scholars of the Talmud derive these seven laws from the Torah itself. Now, you remember that we said that essentially what the scholars of the Talmud were armed with, and we said what the nucleus of the entire system was, what they knew for certain about the seven commandments, which was carried down flawlessly and no one disagreed on. And that was that there are seven prohibitions, the number seven, and there are basically five that that everyone agrees on. We will get to that a little later. There was a disagreement as to what exactly the seven were. We'll get to that a little bit later. But now we're operating with the seven, the basic seven that we're all familiar with, and that's the view of the Talmud that we're taking now. But now the Talmud wants to take it back to the text of the Bible itself, because, as you know, there cannot be any law which does not have its root and does not at least allude it to in the written word of the Torah itself. That is a principle of Torah. Everything in the oral law is always alluded to in some way in the written law itself. And now the Talmud returns to the written law to find where exactly are these seven alluded to. Where do we find in the text itself an allusion to these seven commandments? Okay? And the Talmud, we're going to take up one position. Now, I want to remember as we go through the Talmud that the benefit of Talmud is that we have here the greatest scholars teaching us the sources, but it's not just the sources themselves, but as we go through these sources, we will see different ideas emerge, different concepts, different ideas emerge. That is really more important than the sources themselves, the concepts regarding the sources. And when we're dealing with the seven laws of Noah, we are dealing very closely with philosophical principles, not just there are areas in the Torah which are simply technical halachic structures. They're also very beautiful, and they are, of course, all related along the line somewhere to a philosophical concept, but sometimes it's...
Rebbe, would you explain philosophical processes? Give a definition of it.
Okay. When I say philosophical processes, I mean philosophical and psychological. In the Torah system, you can't separate the two, because if you're dealing with philosophy, you have to be dealing with human psychology, and it is a rare combination. The Torah does not see philosophy and psychology as two separate subjects, but really as one subject, because the purpose, actually there's no name for the subject of the Torah. If you want to give it a name, it would be perfection. Perfection involves two things. First of all, concepts which teach us the proper way of life, okay, true concepts, for instance, true ideas about God do we have in mind, what do we not have in mind, okay, those are philosophical ideas. Or when we speak about ethics, and we will get into that a little later today, tonight I hope, What is ethics? In other words, why can't I steal from my neighbor? Is it because I have to be nice to my neighbor? If so, why? What is it based on? Okay, and we're going to discuss a little bit of that. Those are philosophical concepts. Psychological concepts, and we're going to explain those too, is, for instance, we have, as we go on a little further, we'll find a very strange understanding of idolatry, a different aspect of idolatry that no one in the world really has ever concentrated on. It simply is not in their interests, but Torah does, because the Torah is the is God's system of perfection. And we'll see that there are what the psychological draw of idolatry is, one of the draws. A draw that is a little bit surprising when you look at it. First sight, you don't see it. But there we're dealing with the psychological. Why is man drawn to these things, okay? So the Torah deals with two things. Why man's psyche is drawn to certain things which are not good, and what the good is. What the good is a philosophical question. How man is drawn towards the not good or towards evil is a psychological question. That's what I mean when I say philosophical and psychological. I would say that the, as a matter of history, the Greeks were very heavy on philosophy, not too heavy, pretty light on psychology. Like a person like Socrates, for instance, came to many conclusions about the way of life that are similar to the ideas of Torah, very very close. Some of the truths that he discovered are exactly the same as the truths of Torah. Maimonides mentions this, and if you study Socrates, you'll find out that he actually the ideas that the Torah espouses. A human being can come to those ideas. Abraham came to those ideas on his own. It requires a very unique person to be able to do that, but a person can come to those conclusions. So Torah makes sense. They're rational, and that's philosophy. Torah also, a large part of the Torah, especially the prophets, is to teach man about himself and why he is drawn towards evil, what component it is in his makeup that draws him towards that, and how he should avoid it. That's why the Torah is more than just a philosophy. It doesn't just tell you what is good, but it tells you in what way you're attracted to that which is not good. And that's the psychological aspect. And the Torah sees these two as fundamental. You can't have one without the other. And we're going to be bouncing off between these two things as we go along. And as we go into these seven commandments, we're going to see different concepts over here in philosophy and also in psychology. Okay? Is there any further? It'll become more clear perhaps as we take examples, and maybe I'll point it out as we go along. What is philosophy and what is psychology? All right? Are there any questions at this point? Okay, then let me continue. And the derivations, the importance of the derivations, and this is the difference between learning Talmud in a scholarly manner and just reading Talmud. When a person just reads Talmud, they think, oh, the rabbis are trying to deduce this, and they're trying to find this from this or that verse. It's more than that. It's not just a matter of from which verse. The verses portray ideas. The important thing is the concepts and the ideas that are derived. The verses are nice, and they're important. It's nice to know from which verse we derive what. But that's a technical matter. More important is the concepts and the ideas that we learn that are important in our lives. And if we learn the Talmud properly, we'll see that the ideas open up for us. They really open up these seven laws, what the underlying concepts are. Okay, so let us proceed, and it's a little bit technical. I mean, I can't help it. The Talmud is a science. It's a technical study, though, and you have to have a little bit of patience. You don't just get to the ideas right away, but that's part of the process. In any learning process, there always is a tedious part. I mean, no matter what science a person learns, there's always you have to master certain tedious aspects of the science, and then you get to the heart of it, the beautiful part of it, the ideas. Now, let us take a look over here. We're on 56b, and the Talmud states, where do we know this from? Okay, those are the words of the Talmud. I don't know what your exact translation is, if you have a translation, but in Hebrew it's Menohani Mili. That's an expression which means, from where do we derive this, these seven laws? And the Talmud continues and says, Rabbi Yochanan says it's derived as follows, from this verse. Now, when we say Rabbi Yochanan, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was the first one to come up with this. Many of the things in the Talmud which are by the these are Amoraim. They lived in the rather recent, and they don't go back to Sinai. They're in the year of about the 5th century. So you're going back to that time. But the many of these things were actually had sources much earlier. But it means that Rabbi Yochanan, he was of this opinion. He has something similar, and it's important to understand this because, again, it has to do with the basic structure of Talmud. And that is, some people think, for instance, that the Mishnah didn't come about well, the 3rd century, they worked out the Mishnah. If you're really able to say the Mishnah just emerged in the 3rd century by Rabbi Judah the Prince, these Mishnahs go way back centuries and centuries, and actually the ideas stem from Sinai. But there was a prohibition against publishing any of the works of the oral law. The oral law was always guarded. I wrote that in one of the gaps, I believe. I explained that there was a prohibition against opening up the oral law for everyone to know. One was not allowed to print, to write the oral law. Rabbi Judah the Prince had to make a decision because he saw it was in danger of being lost, and that's why it was written down at that point. And things weren't written down until the scholars of the generation determined that they might be lost. For instance, the Siddur. The Siddur wasn't written down until about the 9th century, okay? The reason is because it wasn't felt that it was going to be lost. But then they saw that there are slight variations that are coming about in different places where they're praying. And they were afraid that these slight variations may be okay, but then it's liable to lead to greater variations and mistakes and errors. So then it was decided that there should be an official Siddur written in order to ensure that there is no deviation. But, of course, at a sacrifice, because once you make things public, there is always the danger, and that's why there was a prohibition against writing the oral law, because an unscrupulous person or an ignorant person can gain access to it, and not knowing the true method of understanding it, will present themselves as an authority and fool masses of people and say, look, I got the same things as these rabbis are telling you, and I'm telling you that it says right here that you can desecrate the Sabbath, and these statements have been made. There's a statement, for instance, in Talmud that says, Rabbi Akiva says, that it's better to make your Shabbos, your Sabbath, as a weekday than to go beg for food. So taken in a literal way, a person say, well, Rabbi Akiva suggested working on the Sabbath. Of course, Rabbi Akiva meant not to eat food, and he's not a scholar, can take things out of context, and people. So once he has access to the oral law, he could claim to be an expert when he's not. And that's why the oral law was always guarded, but it was always written down by the scholars themselves. However, it wasn't made public till the scholars determined that there is a danger of loss, so we have to weigh the danger of loss against the danger of misrepresentation. And this is it's an important principle to remember as you study the Talmud. So when you have a statement from a rabbi, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the first time that this statement was ever made. It means that is his conviction. Of all the statements that he's gone through the ages, there were certain things that were carried down. This is his conviction. To Euclid. Euclid wrote Geometry, three volumes on geometry. And his books, of course, his books on geometry, if a person just looks at them, well, he was the first one that that made all these discoveries in geometry. Phenomenal genius. It's not true. These discoveries in geometry were made for many, many years, decades, and actually centuries before Euclid. But what Euclid did was he took them all and he just organized them in a very beautiful, logical way, and he entitled it Euclid's Elements. And he, this was Euclid's geometry, Euclidean geometry. We still call it Euclidean geometry. But he wasn't the one that made it up. He simply took all the knowledge from before, and he organized it and put it into a form of a book. It's very similar over here also. When you have the statements of the rabbis, many statements predate the author of the statement. The author is merely saying that this is his view. So when he says that this is so, it doesn't mean he originated the thought necessarily. Sometimes, yes. But not always, not even most of the time. He's telling you this is the proper view, and he's mentioned as the author of the statement. Doesn't mean he's the first one that thought of it. Okay, it's important just to know these basic principles of how the Talmud works. So now we have the statement from Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan says, here is where the derivation of the seven laws are from. Now, I will read you the verse, and we will, first you probably will be shocked that this is the verse, but as we go along, you'll see that what the Talmud means in terms of the derivation, and then we'll go into the concepts. The verse is Genesis 2, and it is verse 16. The verse states as follows. And God Almighty commanded on the man, or to the man, saying, from all the trees of the garden you shall eat. But it says double language. Eat, you shall eat. Okay? Eating is the infinitive first. Infinitive eating. Okay. Now the Talmud says, Rabbi Yochanan says that this is the source for the derivation of the seven laws. Okay. Now, I believe last year at the conference I spoke about this, and I mentioned that this verse is the first verse that introduces the, in this account, there are two accounts of the creation of man. There's a reason for that, I went through that. But the second account, it is indicated that man is really a creature who has a divine element, is this verse. Okay? In the first account, it states openly that he was created in the divine image. In the second account, until this point, it does not really mention anywhere that about the fact that he had a divine element. It does say that God created him, and a special creation for man, and that's one of the principles of Torah, that man is not simply the essence of man. His mind did not come about through an evolutionary process, but this was a special gift from God, and that's in verse 7. But nevertheless, it doesn't mention openly that what kind of a being he was, what kind of a level of existence he was. It becomes clear because it states that God commanded the man, saying. Now, commanded means that you must have a being that is capable of receiving commandments, understanding commandments, an intellectual creature, and also a creature who has free will. Because you don't give a command that doesn't have the free will to either do or not do the command, okay? Unless we call it a command. If you give a command to a dog, for instance, but that's just training. That's not a real command. But command to a human being means you're instructing him that this is the good for him, but he has the ability to either refrain or to comply. It's up to him. So this verse is a very important verse. It is the single verse that shows that man was unique, different than all the other creation. He had intelligence. He understood the commandments. He had knowledge. To understand God's commandments requires knowledge. And he had the ability, the free will, to choose whether he would obey or not obey the command. So the human being emerges from this verse. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan says, this is the verse to be able to find an allusion to these seven laws. Okay? Now, let us take a look at the verse, okay? Now, this is the way this is the way it works. It's a little bit different. You might not be used to this